look up at the directors, the VPs, and no one looks like me. No one is female. No one is Asian. You just don't have examples. And I would try to emulate the communication styles of people above me. What might really work well for them did not work for me. Like, I couldn't walk into a boardroom and bang my fist on the table. Like, it didn't track. I was like 5'2", wearing like a cute little hoodie. And like, you know, it looks cute when I try to bang my fist on a table. I really had to kind of come to terms with that and realize like, oh shoot, this is not working for me. I need to lean into how I like to communicate, what is my style.
Welcome to Growth Untold, the podcast where we dive into thoughtful conversations and insightful discussions with world-class people, all with the aim of inspiring, educating, and empowering our listeners.
We are thrilled to have you here with us on this exciting journey to explore the diverse stories and the ideas that have the power to shape the world for the better.
Welcome to Growth Untold, the podcast.
Today, we have the pleasure of hosting a leader in the world of marketing and consumer engagement. From her beginnings at Anheuser-Busch and Bev to her adventures at Ecobee, Travelzoo, and HelloFresh, she has traversed diverse industries with one common thread, an unwavering commitment to excellence and innovation. But our guest is more than just a marketer. According to her LinkedIn bio, she is an impatient meditation student. Love some oxymorons, by the way. And when she's not strategizing campaigns, you might find her navigating the rapids as an overconfident kayaker, fearlessly tackling challenges head on. With hands-on experience spanning brand and performance marketing, she also has played a pivotal role in growth of startups and consumer packaged goods companies, clinching prestigious awards along the way. Buckle up and get ready for an inspiring conversation with Candy Lee. Welcome to the show, Candy.
Thank you. Honestly, such an honor to be here. I'm so excited for this.
Welcome. And what a name, Candy Lee. Is that a nickname, your real name, Candy, the first name, Candy?
Yeah. Getting to the hard-hitting questions first and foremost, Mina. I love it.
Let's break it all down.
Let's go.
Who is this girl with the weird name? No self-described weird name. Maybe the quick backstory there. Immigrant parents, limited English ability. So we moved over here from Hong Kong when I was 4 years old, I think, and somehow my sister got the more socially acceptable name. She's Florence, and I got the cute, quirky name. So I was named Candy. That is actually the full real name. Like, a lot of people think it's Candace, and they'll actually try to be overly formal and say,
right,
hey, Candace. And I'm like, no, it's actually Candy. And yes, my last name is Lee.
All right. Well, but you kind of let us into this already. So immigrants from Hong Kong. Were you born in Hong Kong? Were you born in Canada?
Yeah, born in Hong Kong, this was in the early 90s. At the time, there was just like a massive migration from Hong Kong into Canada, and I think ended up a lot of folks ended up settling in Vancouver and Toronto. So my family settled in Vancouver, and that's really, for me, that's where I call home. That's really where I spent most of my life, where I grew up, where I went to college, all that good stuff. So
yeah.
And what was your childhood like growing up in Vancouver?
Rainy, very wet. Everything you hear about Vancouver and rain is true. I do love it. Yeah. Like, I live in Toronto now, and I wish you could combine the two cities because they're both so awesome, but they're so different. I think anyone that lives or is from the West Coast will tell you everyone is so chill. The ocean, the mountains, that's people walk a little slower in all the best ways. But it's growing up was really great, but albeit a little bit on the rainy side.
Yeah. And what did your parents do in Hong Kong? And did they do the same thing when they moved to Vancouver, or did they have to get other jobs?
Yeah, that's such a great question, because you're right in that oftentimes I think the Canadian immigrant story is that there is quite a dramatic change when you move to a new country. I would say growing up, my dad was actually always in finance and banking, and he actually stayed in Asia. Just, you know, my parents split when I was pretty young. And so it was just my mom, my sister, and myself. We were kind of like the three musketeers. And then we kind of had the very typical immigrant, I would say, growing up story where, my mom, I think, didn't speak the most English and just really kind of had to take a little bit of, I would say, a downgrade in her career. So I think for me, those were really my formative years, seeing her take on 2-3 waitress jobs at any given time. And You know, you learn a lot of really wonderful things like work ethic, you know, and also how to be resilient and all of that good stuff. But it also, I think, as a kid for my sister and I, made us just really independent. Like, you know, there were times where, you know, mom had to step out to run to the bank and you're like, should I be allowed and supervised at home for a couple hours? And you kind of just learn and you just manage. And yeah. I think a lot of the attributes I have now are probably from those, as with anyone, from those early years.
Yeah, my dad was a satellite engineer back in Egypt and immigrated to Canada and started really having to take care of the family. He didn't have time to go back to college and get his equivalency. And so he picked up odd jobs. Like, he worked at a VHS factory for a while. He delivered pizzas for a little bit.
Wow.
Until he kind of found a job kind of in his field. And he started working as a, you know, in a cell phone company and eventually for a company that serviced Rogers. But, you know, that was me, my two sisters, my mom and my dad. And you, it was just your sister and your mom, three yeah. women in Vancouver. Like, that must have been tough. That must have been hard.
Yeah, I think back to it now as sort of like high highs and low lows, definitely. Like, definitely, you know, you remember when money was tight. And we were also living in a neighborhood where over the years it was getting more and more rough, like in, just right in front of my eyes. But there's, you know what, I think when you're a kid, you don't know that you're poor. You know what
right.
I mean? And that was like the ignorance is bliss. This was really a great gift. You just, all you saw was the work ethic. And it wasn't like you would look at your mom working three waitress jobs and be like, wow, she's working harder than others. You're like, that is just your default. People do work that hard. And, you know, I think I was lucky to also just like, you know, meet some really great, you know, friends in elementary school. And so I think even despite maybe on the outside looking in there being objectively tougher circumstances, I've always felt really like well insulated, whether it was through friends and aunties and, you know, whatever my mom could do and provide to keep the household fun. But looking back now, I was like, yeah, I guess I was like a little bit of like a tougher situation growing up. But I think it was maybe a little bit, not masked, but maybe made easier by the fact that there were just so many people in our neighborhood living that same immigrant life.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like I was, you know, more poor or had less money. Like, it was just like a known thing that everyone in our neighborhood, everyone in our school, like, money was tight. It was very like immigrant fed. And so that was your normal. And so that was the nice thing, I think, maybe growing up, was like I actually didn't feel as like othered because of my neighborhood.
Yeah, it really is like a weird thing when you're a kid. Like, you know, when I was a kid too, for the first few Christmases, we got Christmas presents from like the Christmas present bank, or, you know, the Salvation Army. You don't really realize that you're poor until you are compared to other people. Like, I remember the first time I went to like a good friend's house for Christmas, and it was like the first Christmas I had ever went to a friend's house. And he was opening up these presents, and I just started to realize, I'm like, oh shit, we poor. Like, this is, what the heck is this? I'm getting like a music CD for Christmas, and he's opening up like a Lego set or whatever. And you're like, oh damn. So, but you don't realize it as a kid. You're right, because you have nothing to compare it to. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think
so
that's one of the things me and Alex talk about, is like, comparison is the thief of all joy. Because
totally.
Once you compare yourself to other people and start going, well, I don't have as much as them, I'm not doing as good as them, when you really start getting depressed and down on your luck. But like you were saying, you and your sisters, you were just like watching your mom work her butt off and going, yeah, that's what everyone's doing. Like, that's how you should be.
Yeah,
so it's weird,
yeah.
Man, that like that child naivete is like, I miss that.
Yeah. And there are, I think, joys that come out of, you know, whether it's the immigrant life or whatever you call it, or at least like my childhood, like there are little joys that you can kind of look back and like laugh on now. Like, you know, I just remember like, there wasn't really a sense of like, you know, on Christmas morning, you don't wake up to like milk and half eaten cookies. You know, when you lose a tooth, you don't have like the magic tooth fairy come and give you, you know, a couple bucks like under your pillow. But I just remember like coming home from school and hearing it from my, you know, friends, and asking my mom, well, where's my money? like I lost a tooth. And she's like, oh, you, this is like so not politically correct. But she'd say back to me like, you know better. You know the truth. Like, you're just like, okay, sure. I'm seven. Like, yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah, she's but like, you need to grow up fast. Like, yeah, we're not playing into this
she
stuff.
She was smart. She positioned it as like, no, you're smarter than them. And really, she was just trying to get out of like, give me a couple bucks.
Yeah, like, yeah. Yeah, but also like, she didn't kind of like, she probably didn't have time to like baby you your sister, right? It's like, no, it's a hard life out there and like this isn't real. Like, yeah, my parents were the same way. I think Santa Claus was the only thing they kind of like tried to convince, not even tried to convince us on. They just didn't do anything to like not make us believe it. But everything else, like the Easter Bunny and the Tooth Fairy and like all this other stuff, they were like not having it. They were not going to play into that. They were like, no. Yeah. Like, I think they literally just ignored me when I asked them about it. They were just like, that was it. They just stared at me. There was just, it's like the Tooth Fairy. And they were like, no. Like, that was it.
No. Right. I think, you know what's funny? I actually think in elementary school, you were the one who told me that Santa Claus doesn't exist.
Really? Was it me?
Oh, yeah. Mina matured at a much faster rate than I did in elementary school. Like, I was running around like a golden retriever. And
You were a little bit more whitewashed than I was and my family. You guys were still very, like, culturally in tune, but I would say you were more whitewashed than I was.
It's funny because I always make fun of my mom for this. My dad still has a Trinidadian accent. My mom and dad grew up in Trinidad and Tobago.
Oh, wow.
But my aunts and uncles, they have maintained their cultural integrity.
They've got heavy accents.
Oh, they got really heavy accents to the point where my girlfriend Denny is like, what is your Uncle Junior saying like at family get together? She's just like, and she has no idea what he's saying, right?
Yeah,
she
yeah.
just laughs and smiles
oh
at everything.
God.
But I wasn't, because my mom worked at the bank at Scotiabank, and my dad became a realtor. But they've changed, they code switched. Right, they like change the way they speak, and then when my dad gets in the car, the Trinidadian accent comes. Yeah, come on, boy, I must smuck you up, you know.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
and then I'm like, Dad, why don't you speak like that to people?
Yeah.
Right, and then he just switches it up. Did your mom code switch, like growing up? Did she like?
It was a hard no.
hard no. She was the same all the time.
Yeah, it was like such a refusal to get better at English. Like, she'd grudgingly, and actually, I think in the last decade or so, as we've grown up, she like definitely like switched back to like, I don't know how, but her English has degraded so much now.
Because she's probably just stopped trying. Yeah, my parents did
totally.
My parents did that too. My dad, because he worked with cell phones all day, he didn't really need to talk to anyone that much. He was a manager, so he managed the other technicians, but, you know, they're all working on cell phones, so they don't really need to talk. And my mom worked at a coffee shop, so she was dealing with customers all day. So when they first immigrated, my dad was way better at English than my mom.
Right,
but
yeah.
she started working at a coffee shop. He started working with cell phones, and my mom is a very social person. So then her English got way better than my dad, and my dad kind of degraded. So it was interesting seeing that switch just, you know, based on what they did. So you grew up with your sister. At what point did you kind of say to yourself, I want to go into marketing. Marketing is what I want to do.
Yeah. Such a good question. I definitely less of a linear path than most. Although I think looking back, there was always a bit of like an affinity for the things that marketing represent. Like, I remember when I was a kid, I always just loved like telling stories. I always loved making people laugh and eliciting some kind of emotion. And it's probably pretty similar to your line of work, Mina. It's, you know, just this desire to like make people around you happy or feel something. And so that was sort of me as a kid. And so when I sort of look back now and think about my marketing career, that is a lot of marketing, is how do you kind of break through and elicit some kind of an emotional reaction or action from someone. But it wasn't always like immediately clear to me. I think all through high school, I did reasonably well in academics as an Asian kid. And, you know, at some point, I think in high school, I was like, oh, maybe I'll be an accountant. Maybe I'll like, you know, just like all the usual Asian things, like, you know, doctor, lawyer, that type of thing. Didn't really feel a massive affinity for any of it. And then just honestly went to university, also didn't really know what to major in. So I just thought, what the heck? Why not business? You get to wear business suits. So that sounds pretty cool.
Did you feel like you were underperforming because you were Asian? Like, did you feel that pressure because you were Asian and the stereotypes that the world puts on you that you should have been performing better?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think luckily my mother was always, you know, to be honest, she was often like so busy working that there was less time to put the like pressure on me. It wasn't like a, hey, you got only 97 on your math test. What about the other 3 points? But I would say there was a lot of pressure on me, but it was probably more so pressure I put on myself.
Okay.
So I was always just very, very driven. I think maybe because my childhood was a little chaotic, you know, years and years of therapy later, I, you know, learn now, it's like, oh, well, probably doesn't take like a crazy, you know, scientist to figure out that, okay, well, maybe as a kid or as a teenager, you're just looking for ways you can control in a slightly chaotic household. And ways you can give some control to your life is doing well in school, having, you know, killing it on your first job and things like that. And that really kind of set that type of DNA in me to maybe like achieve. So, yeah, always did well in school. I think a lot of the pressure was maybe self-inflicted, certainly. And then, you know, as I went to university, you know, very quickly realized in a commerce degree, you actually don't wear business suits as often as I thought. Ended up, you know, and in my final couple years at I went to University of British Columbia in Vancouver. And then in my final couple years, you have to pick a major. And, you know, it was quickly very apparent that I wasn't smart enough to go into finance. And then I didn't really want to do like human resources or anything like that. And so marketing was honestly just a bit of like a wild shot, like default. Sure, why not? And then when I graduated university, still wasn't quite sure I wanted to be in marketing. I think I just felt like the world's my oyster. I want to do everything and anything. And I just had a real thirst for learning everything that it felt like I didn't want to pigeonhole myself into just marketing. So ended up, you know, backpacking by myself for like 6+ months in Southeast Asia. Southeast Asia. I went to like first Australia and then Thailand, Vietnam, Laos, a short stint in Singapore. Wow. Super amazing trip. But ended up coming back and then being able to find and start a gig with Anheuser-Busch InBev, which present day is the biggest beer company in the world. They own brands like Budweiser, Corona, Stella Artois, the list goes on.
Yeah.
But I was really lucky there because they had a sort of 2-year, they call it the Global Management Trainee Program, where you can basically go in for the first 2 years and there's like a class of these trainees every single year. And basically, you get to sample all these different jobs and departments and careers in your first 2 years at the company. And so for me, that seemed perfect because I thought, okay, well, great. I don't quite know what I want to do. And here is a program where for 2 years, I get to do what seems like everything. And so took the offer, joined the company, sampled a bunch of different everything from sales to, you know, a little bit of like sales intelligence analytics to, you know, sponsorship to, yeah, it was, I worked a little bit in like a distribution warehouse, a little bit of finance work, all the things. And then honestly, ultimately just kept kind of side eyeing at everyone that was in the marketing department at the time and just felt like, wow, shit, it seems like they're doing some really cool stuff. And yeah. So I think it was then that I was like, okay, let's actually get into marketing and see what this is all about. So
do you think you traveling for 6 months really opened your eyes at that time in your life to kind of realize what you wanted to do? Was it because a lot of people go straight from college or university and they just go straight into a job? And I always think like traveling really does help you kind of realize what you want to do. You get to kind of live in the real world for a little bit. Did that kind of help you in any way, you think?
Yeah, absolutely. It was really, I would say, transformative in unexpected ways. It wasn't necessarily the type of like soul searching trip where I ended the 6 months thinking, now I know what I want to do with my life. And, you know, wow, maybe I was hopeful for that. I don't know. It's been so long. I think where it did transform me was a couple things. It was actually an accidental solo trip. I actually started it was meant to be a 5-6 month backpacking trip. I was supposed to go with a friend that I actually just met in my last semester at school and started off the trip. Everything went well. And I think something like 1 or 2 weeks in, he just announced to me one morning that, hey, I'm really homesick. I've booked my flight home. Can you drive me to the airport? And wow. So it was a real like accidental solo backpacking trip. And I was just like floored and in shock. And looking back now, should you have like agreed to go on a 6-month backpacking trip with someone you just met in your last semester at school? But I guess I had a bit of a spontaneous personality at the time. But yeah, I remember just being in like total shock, driving him to the airport and then sitting down at a cafe in like Melbourne, Australia, thinking, oh shit, what now? Like, do I go home? Like, I'm just like tiny little 5'2" female Asian, like by myself, like in a strange country with a backpack and nothing else and not that much money. And then, you know, I think I kind of felt like I had a few choices. I could go home or I could just spend the entire 6 months in Australia because that was, quote unquote, a little bit more of like a comfortable and maybe safer spot with better infrastructure. And then honestly, I think I just ended up landing on like, okay, well, fuck, maybe I'll just do this. And I think I had also like a little bit of resentment towards like the person that bailed on the trip. And I was like, well, fuck him. I'm going to like have the best trip ever. I'm going to do everything in my power to make this the best trip of my life. And I think so I share that in that it was transformative in that way, in that it so pushed me out of my comfort zone. And, you know, I think the impact it's had on my life and career now is that it's just completely changed my relationship with risk.
Yeah.
Because if you are by yourself in the middle of the night in Laos or Thailand or Vietnam, like you do have to grow up quickly and make certain choices and be a little bit more street smart maybe. And so I think if I look back maybe at some of my life choices or my career, I do think maybe I do as a result of that trip take more risk.
Yeah.
And I've actually recently, maybe in the last year or two, read this article which had like actually some really fascinating research that made me think back to that trip, which is that they looked at, I don't know, it was probably some Harvard article, but they looked at like a cross section of a zillion CEOs and they said, well, what is it that CEOs do differently that makes them get to the top of the ladder? Because a lot of people have the ambition to, not everyone obviously makes it to CEO level. And the single most important thing they found as the driver was that CEOs tend to take far more risk. They tend to be a lot more risk loving. And, you know, when I saw that, I just really thought back to that trip. I was like, it completely changed my relationship with risk.
Yeah. And I. And as you were saying that, I couldn't help but think of your mom in that sense that she kind of left her, you know, the man in her life as well and took her two daughters and immigrated. And you had this guy just leave you and you were like, screw that, I'm going to do this alone. So that's like, I always try to see the comparison because we do end up being a lot like our parents in a lot of ways as we grow up. So you came back from this trip and you went to Anheuser-Busch. I do have a Dharma. We all have Dharma, which for those of you who don't know, Dharma is one's life purpose. You want to find the purpose in your life.
There you go.
But nice. I have a gin company called Dharma Gin. So I've in the alcohol space over the last couple of years. And of course, Anheuser-Busch is, like you said, one of the biggest, you know, beverage companies in the world, but beer companies in the world. And you talked about how that experience was really great because you got to do a little bit of everything. But I want to pick your brain a little bit about the alcohol space in general. Yeah. How have you seen it change, or have you even given it much thought? Because I'm sure it was a lot different than it is now back then. How do you think the alcohol industry has changed over the years?
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I did spend close to a decade at AB InBev. And I mean, those were some of the most like early informative years of my career. So I owe a lot of the things I've learned to the time at that company. And but I think once you've been at a company for such a long stint, it's always kind of in your DNA a little bit. So definitely anytime I'm in like a liquor store or a bar, I'm like scouting out what's in the back bar and scouting out like wine labels and designs. I think for me, you know, take this as one person's opinion, what hasn't changed is the like absolutely critical need to drive emotional, sort of elicit some kind of emotional reaction. I remember when we were at AB InBev, we had done so many studies on, you know, whether people could really taste the difference in different beers. So when you do blind taste tests of, hey, you line up 5 different beers from different brands, remove the label, can you tell the difference? Everyone thinks they can tell the difference between a Heineken or a Corona. You remove the label, no one can. I dare you to do this at like a house party on a Friday or Saturday night. Like everyone is always so cocky when they like start the test, and then when they like fail inevitably, they're like, oh shoot. But it just shows the power of marketing. So I think that is absolutely true, and that is always going to be true, and that hasn't changed. I think it's more what has changed maybe in the last 10, 15, 20 years is the two things in my mind, like the way the brand is delivered and distributed. I think it's a much more decentralized model now. It used to be that you could run one Super Bowl ad or a massive TV campaign and everyone would be like, oh my God, this is amazing. I must try drink, drink, drink. I think now it's a lot more decentralized. Like I just, even when I think about the evolution of my time at AB InBev, when we started, it was just like TV campaigns. And by the time I left, we were like, oh, this is like a 17 channel plan because we need influencers and all of our social accounts and this like blog content and a TV spot and. So yeah. It's a lot more decentralized, but I think it just means there's a lot of really creative, unique ways to tell the story through different lens, but it's also just like honestly a lot more work and there's like a reality to that. I think the second thing that's different and probably better in the world of marketing now, but it is very different, is consumers and end users just are so much better at calling out the BS in marketing. And we all see this, like it's so easy to like see an ad from any brand and now just be able to quickly comment on that like Instagram post and be like, yeah, that's like total BS, like you're lying, and like let me do the back research. And so I think people are just a lot smarter now, and they should be, and that's good for holding marketers accountable.
Yeah, it's crazy that you say that, because in alcohol there's so many more brands now than ever before. Yeah. You know, when it comes to beer, it comes to gin, it comes to tequila, my God, tequila. There's just so many brands now. But then I always try to compare other markets that I may not be as an expert in to my own. And when I take a look at like my market as well, like entertainment, Hollywood, film and television, actors, I'm like, there's a lot more brands there too. Like back in the day, there weren't many like actors. There just weren't. Like acting brands were like Al Pacino, Christian Bale. Of course, there were more, but you know what I'm talking about. Like, there just weren't as many. And now there's just so many brands when it comes to, like, actors that you really have to find how you're going to differentiate yourself, how are you going to be desirable in the marketplace, how are you going to stand out. And I think it's the same way for, like, almost all categories now. There's so many brands. Almost anyone can start a brand or, you know, be like, I want to be an actor. I want to do this. I want to start an alcohol brand. It's like, how do you stick out and how do you differentiate yourself? It's almost kind of overwhelming. Like, how do you do it?
Yeah.
Yeah. You just prompted my memory on something that I think it was one of the maybe like the last, whether it was like studies or some kind of like research we did before I left AB InBev. And it was like, just the idea that even the word and the idea of loyalty of brands has changed a lot. It's not that people are less or more loyal. It's how we define loyalty of brands. And so, you know, it could be that maybe like 20, 30 years ago, whatever brand our parents would drink, they're like, I'm like a Heineken guy. I'm a Heineken guy for life. And that is the only beer I'll ever drink. And I am loyal. And then present day, I could say, hey, I'm really loyal to my favorite wine and gin brands. But my definition of loyalty is like, oh, I have this cluster of like 9 wine brands that I really like. And I have this cluster of 6 gin brands I really like. And that's how I define loyalty. And so it's not that we're not more or less loyal. It's that it's defined very differently. And you're right. You know, we know people are so bombarded these days. And so I know in the marketing field, like we kind of sometimes joke, like just the consumer cycle goes through like 5-10 year ranges between being very minimalist and being very maximalist.
Right.
I think right now, even in terms of like design, ads, content, copywriting, all of that stuff, I tend to think we're in a bit more of like a loud maximalist kind of phase right now. And you see it in pop culture as well. But I do wonder if like we're going to start very quickly going back to a minimalist side of phase, because it's just too much. Like even just the amount of ads you're bombarded when you're on social media.
Yeah, it's a ton.
Yeah, that's true. So we spoke a little bit about ABI and your experience over there. Can we talk a little bit about Homebase? First of all, I love the name Homebase. Because you think of Homebase, you think of like, you know, where you belong at the end of the day, right? What is Homebase? What's this company all about?
Yeah. Maybe a bit of context. So currently I lead the marketing and growth team at Homebase as CMO. So it's a tech startup. We actually just announced our Series D fundraise a couple weeks ago, which we're super excited about. You know, if I were to describe Homebase in one sentence, it would be that we're the everything app for hourly work. What that actually means is that we service brick and mortar local businesses. So that is your, you know, retail stores, your restaurants, everything on Main Street that typically has like a storefront. We know one of the biggest stressors for a small business owner is your team, your people. Like, are they going to show up for a shift? Are they not going to show up for a shift? Oh my God, did I set my shift schedule? Did I pay them on time? And so basically that's what we do, is like everything you need to do to manage your hourly team of people. That's what this app does. So, it's been there for a year and a half. It's been a blast. You know, I think it's important to tie, if you're going to spend a lot of hours at work anyway, it's important to tie it to something that gives you purpose. And for me, my mom did actually, as the years went on, she did have a few of her own small businesses. And so, you know, Homebase just seemed like such a good fit when I was maybe looking for my next opportunity to be able to give back to small business. And, you know, we really do genuinely believe that, you know, this sounds like an ad now, but the product does make the lives a little bit less stressful and easier and simpler for small business owners.
Yeah. And talk about that experience from, you went from Ad and Bev and other smaller stints at like HelloFresh. So most of this stuff I would say is B2C, business to customer. And then you're in an area that's B2B, more focused on the business itself. Would like talk us through those nuances of doing that kind of marketing.
Yeah, you're right. Technically, we are B2B on paper, but I would actually say our users shop and behave and consume media in a way that is more B2C. If you are a, you know, first time donut shop owner, you're probably not, you know, trying to buy like massive like enterprise software and doing a request for proposal. You're just like, shoot, I need an app to manage my team. Let me quickly Google something.
Yeah, I have like four employees or five employees.
Exactly. Yeah. But I would say, you know, there is the shift, and you're right in that most of my career has been consumer facing brands rather than like B2B business to business brands. I would say actually probably the bigger shift in my career was when I moved from maybe InBev, which is kind of like, you know, huge, like global corporation, to about 10 years ago, the tech startup space. That was probably a little bit more of a dramatic shift for me. And I think at the time, I was starting to, you know, get close to hitting my decade at AB InBev, and, you know, never thought I would say at a company close to 10 years. It was kind of a crazy idea. But then as you get towards that milestone, it does force a bit of a self-reflection. And so you lift your head up a bit and realize, oh, shoot, do I want to be a lifer here or do I want to try something new? And so at the time, it just felt like when I looked on the, you know, looked across the street to the other lawns out there, it felt like there was really cool, exciting marketing being done in the tech startup space, that they had completely rewritten the rules of marketing. It was a lot more data driven. It was just like at the leading edge of a lot of like new, fresh thinking. And so that's where I said, okay, let's just take the plunge and do it. And you know, that path since have, you know, built and ramped up teams in marketing across a few different startups, but that's sort of what got me to Homebase.
Wow. Pretty cool. And it seems like just like from our seeing you on like posting about it on LinkedIn, it just seems like this one is like really hits close to home, no pun intended.
Would you like to write copy for our next
maybe ads? There you go.
I'm looking for a copywriter. Yeah.
But okay, so like I just feel like this is a cool new chapter in your life. It's very, very purpose driven, and I'm not saying the stuff that you did before wasn't, but you know, it's like sports and entertainment. You think when you think of the beer industry, right? And then startup, you know, and then now you're at Homebase, which is like a company that's supporting really the smaller players in the industry. Like, how does that feel, I guess, operating that realm to you specifically as a marketer? And like, what are some new ways you're thinking of connecting to culture in a meaningful way?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, there's a few things that made Homebase as a marketing opportunity to me really, really attractive, and Homebase as a company as well. I mean, on the company side, you know, it was a pretty easy choice because the purpose, the mission, who doesn't love small business? and who doesn't want to support small business. And I think through the pandemic, we all cared, like as a society, we all cared so much about local business. Everyone was like, go help the local bakery, go buy your groceries from the corner store. Like, what can we do to help local business? And so that, you know, was super resonant to me, as well as, you know, certainly my mom's own small businesses. And then on the company side, you know, not only did I love the purpose, but I also really loved the people as I was getting to know them. And it sounds a little bit cliche to say, oh, it's all about the people, but it really was for me. I actually wasn't looking to move. I was previously leading marketing at HelloFresh, the meal kit subscription company, and I was pretty happy there. We were growing like crazy. But when certainly when Homebase reached out, the more I met with the people, the more I realized, wow, like, they're nice and smart. And usually in tech, you get one or the other. You don't get both.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of like a, I think just kind of like a, you know, maybe like a funny stereotype about tech, that I was really lucky to kind of meet these folks. And that was really fun to be able to say, okay, wow, actually, you know, trying to build a startup is really, really, really hard work, as with a lot of different careers. You know, it struck me that these are people I want to be in the trenches with. You know, when times are hard, you want good people around you, and you want to be with people who are solutions minded. And I really felt that energy from these people. So those were kind of like two of the things that made this opportunity super, super interesting.
I've always been fascinated by the tech startup space, especially in the last, you know, 20 years. It seems like that's like the hot thing to do now, especially if you're an entrepreneur, like tech startups. From what you've seen, what's the goal of these people who are starting all these companies? Like, is it to start a business and then sell out and cash out big? Are they, you know, doing it because they're actually passionate about it? Like, why is everybody, especially our generation and the younger generation, all getting into tech startups? Like, what's the hype about?
Yeah. You're so right in that. Even just like it, where people want to work has changed so much. I remember speaking not too long ago at a local university, and I remember when I first got out of school and I was speaking at universities, everyone would come up to me. The students would come up to me after and say, you know, I want to get into finance. How do I get into finance? Or I want to get into consulting. How do I do that? But it's funny, you fast forward 10, 15 years and everyone comes up to you after and says, I want to be an entrepreneur. I want to be at a startup. How do I do that? And so you're right in that there is a shift in the sexiness badge from finance and accounting to startups. And Tamina, to go back to your question on what are people after, I think the reality is there is a lot of money in tech. And so where there is maybe like quote unquote money and power, it attracts a lot of different types of personalities and lots of good intention. I kind of say this jokingly, but, you know, lots of good intention. So I do think you do have a brand of serial entrepreneurs who are just really got that DNA to like, and a machine that can build a startup, sell it, build a startup, sell it. So you do often see in tech, you know, 3, 4, 5 time founders, and they build great companies that actually do make life easier. And then you have another subsect of, you know, a lot of founders will really want to stick in it for the long haul. And I would probably argue that, you know, John, our founder and CEO at Homebase, he's probably more of this clan. Like, he really does. He has a background with family and friends working in small business, and he saw how neglected small business were with tech tools. Like, he was like, why is everyone still building their weekly schedule on pen and paper and then texting it to their staff? Like, it's so archaic. Yeah. And so, you know, there are founders like him who are really here to build a generational company and sticking it with the long haul. And, you know, it's kind of almost like the Steve Jobs of the world or the Jeff Bezos, you know, like they're in it for the long haul and they want to build something really big that's, you know, world changing. So I think you kind of get all types.
Yeah, I think from the guests we've had on, I'm realizing a shift of entrepreneurs starting companies to help small businesses. That's like been a real shift I've noticed. I think if you look back like 10 years ago, tech startups were really created to help like big businesses. Yep. Like big business. How do we make their lives easier? How do we make them more efficient? And now from even the people that we're sitting down with, I'm like, yo, like I think there's another wave of businesses being started to help small business. Yep. And how do we, you know, cultivate that as well. I think there's also something about like money was so cheap, you know, you could take out a ton of money for really low interest rates that a lot of people were like, let's start a tech startup. We can go get loans at like 0%, 1%, 2%. And now that's not happening anymore. So I wonder if there's going to kind of be a decline in starting, you know, businesses from the ground up like that. So we talked about, you know, what are the goals of tech startups? What are your goals? Like, what do you want to do? What, you know, what's your purpose and your road? Are you kind of just taking things day by day? Or, you know, do you have a goal for the next 10 years of where you want to be?
Yeah, my goals are super boring, but I like them. You know, honestly, I think some people tend to build like 3, 5, 10-year plans. I've actually never done that in my life, despite, you know, being fairly type A. I've just never done that. I've never been like, oh, I need like to be at X level by X age or whatever. I think with my, at least more so with my career, and I guess a lot of my life choices, I've kind of always just operated on gut. And so for me, I do feel really lucky and privileged to be to maybe have had the experiences I've had from like a career perspective. I definitely know I'm in a really lucky spot. I think these days, you know, the goals are fairly simple. They're like, do I have great relationships in my life? Am I healthy? You know, am I doing right by my team at work? Are they set up to unlock their best work and be their best selves? And have I created like a safe space for them? Are we doing like really cool game-changing work that we think can, just in our pocket of the universe, you know, create some real change and make life easier for everyone? So it's honestly really the simple things. And I think operating by gut on some of my biggest life choices has always worked for me. And so probably still operate by gut for the next 10 years plus. And, you know, you'll see. Check in with me in 10 years, and maybe I'll quickly revert and change my mind and said, do not operate on gut. Please don't.
This is so on brand with you being super spontaneous. I feel like this is the first full circle, operating gut, being spontaneous, being adventurous. I feel like that's just been your whole brand throughout this whole podcast interview.
Yeah, I guess this is I guess you're right. It's you know, you do try to have like a, you know, pro con list and things like that. I think there's, over the years, you do build a little bit of structure in how you make decisions. Like certainly when I looked at the opportunity at Homebase, you know, there were some pro con lists. You have to kind of make sure, is this the right timing as well? I think that's maybe one of the things I've layered on is you know, as the years go by, you do realize sometimes timing is everything. Like, do I have the energy, like, do I have the emotional energy to take on a new challenge? It's really exhausting starting a new job. Are the other pieces of my life in a position where I can take on a new challenge, which I know will take a lot out of me over the next 1 or 2 years to start? So I think maybe there's some structure, but you're right in that for the most part, it's been a lot gut. And you kind of try to layer on a bit of rational thought on top.
Yeah.
All right. So I know you got to head out very soon. You're on a tight schedule. You've got to meet with your CEO. Important meeting. It's the life of a tech startup. Before you go, you know, we, of course, have a lot of ethnic people listening to this podcast, and we're all about championing diversity, championing ethnic diversity. For someone who's trying to get into the world of tech startups or C-level, you know, C-level positions, what's some advice that you would give to our listeners about building their career and you know, achieving their goals?
Yeah, it's a great question. I love it, and it's making me think. You know, I think first and foremost, you know, for someone who is ambitious and maybe wants to be a C-level or a CEO or an entrepreneur or just do really great things in their career, I think first and foremost, it actually almost starts with like understanding the why behind it. I heard this quote once, which really stuck with me around careers, and it was something to the effect of, I'm probably misquoting it, like earlier on in your career, you're hired for what you do. And later on at more senior levels, you're actually hired for who you are. And so understanding your why and what are your principles, your values, how you like to lead, why are you interested in this role beyond the job title? That becomes really, really important because there are days where it is a grind. There are days where it is like 1 a.m. and you're trying to create like board slides and you're like, oh God, like why did I sign up for this job? And so at moments like that, you have to go back to your why. And I think for me, a lot of my why is, you know, I do love leading people. It's a privilege, but it's also a burden as well on some days because you have to make really hard decisions. It's, you know, you feel like you're always never doing enough for your people. I'm not a parent, but I've heard for parents, it's like there are some parallel challenges of like you just always feel like you're behind. You're always feeling like you could do more for your people. But I think understanding your why first and foremost is super critical. And that's helped. Yeah, that's been a really great North Star for me. I think the other piece as well is the other tip I would have is finding a way to communicate. I guess it's finding your voice, finding a way to communicate that works for you and fits with you and feels nice for you. And I say this because I think there were just times earlier in my career where, you know, you have no role models. Like there's no one that is like, you know, when I was at AB InBev in the early days, like, you know, you look up at the directors, the VPs, and no one looks like me. No one is female, no one is Asian. You just don't have examples. And so I think earlier on in my career, I would try to emulate the communication styles of people above me, but they're all like white dudes. And so, you know, what might really work well for them, like certainly when I was trying it, did not work for me. Like I couldn't walk into a boardroom and like, you know, like bang my fist on the table. Like it didn't track. It didn't look good. I was like 5'2" wearing like a cute little hoodie. And like, you know, it looks cute when I try to bang my fist on a table. And so, you know, I think that, you know, I really had to kind of come to terms with that and realize like, oh, shoot, this is not working for me. I need to lean into how I like to communicate, what is my style. And I like to be jokey. I like to be casual. I like to swear. That's my natural mode of communication. And so over time, you just learn you have to actually constantly understand what actually works for you. And in the tech world, we talk a lot about A/B testing, which is just like constantly testing and iterating new approaches. And so I think that's worked well for me. It's like I'm just constantly A/B testing. How do I communicate? Okay, well, this didn't work with that person. Okay, maybe next time in our next one-on-one, I'm going to try another way. But how do I do it in a way that just feels natural? Because I think when you're trying to communicate in a way that maybe emulates someone else or isn't just a fit for you, it's exhausting.
Yeah.
It's really exhausting. And so I think that would be my second tip. And then I think third and last is like be yourself. You know, Mina, you said something at the beginning of our interview, which was, you know, do you feel like society gave you a lot of pressure to succeed, et cetera? Maybe not for that specific question, but I think certainly in the working world, there is a lot of societal expectations. And there sometimes is still, I would say, a lot of knowledge to be had by people around you on what does it mean to be female or BIPOC. And you can't expect them to know. And so just making sure there's always going to be a pressure to be someone else. So make sure you feel really centered and grounded and just be yourself. And that's kind of a daily reminder. Sometimes it's harder. Some days it's easier and some days mm-hmm. it's harder.
Yeah. Well, listen, I'm proud of people like us. I'm proud of immigrants like us. I'm proud of our generation for paving the way for the younger generation. Hopefully they don't feel the same kind of lack of role models that we felt growing up. So, you know, thank you for doing that. Continue to kill it at home base and, you know, wishing you all the best there and any future endeavors. Thank you for taking the time to come on Growth Untold.
Thanks, Candy.
And tell us your story and tell us where you're from and what you're all about. So wishing you all the best.
Absolutely. No, it was truly such an honor. You two made it super easy and comfortable. Really appreciate it. And thanks again.
Thanks for tuning in and listening. Please subscribe, share, and join the journey of Growth Untold. Don't miss a single nugget. Hit that follow button now on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, and Instagram.